Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran is questioning the seriousness of the United States as well as its European counterparts, which were signatories to the JCPOA. This after the U.S. has issued new sanctions against Iran, and the Europeans have issued a statement telling Iran to change course regarding its nuclear commitments. Iran says it is committed to the original deal, if all of the signatories are, but that it will not renegotiate and talk about any other issues. In other words, Iran's defense and security are not up for negotiations.
The Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, got into trouble in May 2018 when then-US President Donald Trump unilaterally abandoned it and reimposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In January this year, when Trump's successor, Joe Biden, took office, he expressed willingness to return to the deal. Accordingly, Tehran and the remaining JCPOA parties, namely China, Russia, the UK, France, and Germany, began talks in Vienna in April. Six rounds of negotiations were held before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. Now, Iran's foreign minister has questioned that whether the U.S. is serious to return to the JCPOA.
If there is a serious will in Washington to return to the deal, there is no need for all these negotiations at all. It is enough for the U.S. president to issue an executive order tomorrow and announce that the U.S. is joining the pact from the point where the Trump administration left.
On Friday, the U.S. imposed fresh sanctions targeting Iran's drone program, a move drawing a reaction from the Iranian Foreign Ministry.
The imposition of new sanctions reflect the completely contradictory behavior of the White House, an administration that talks about returning to the JCPOA and is following the same methods of the Trump administration by imposing sanctions, is sending a message that it is not trustworthy at all.
Iran's drone program, along with its missile program, is among issues that the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies say must be included in talks over the JCPOA. That's what Iran has time and again rejected, saying its defense program remains non-negotiable.
Iran's defense capability is a matter of national decision that is intertwined with the country's national interests and security. Therefore, no country has the right to speak or comment on this issue.
Iran says it is interested in continuing the Vienna talks, but the negotiations must be result-oriented and lead to the removal of the sanctions in a verifiable manner. However, the White House persists in exerting pressure on Iran to speed up the talks, a policy that Russia believes is unhelpful.
Pressure on Iran to speed up will. The experience shows that it doesn't help. Either you do it bilaterally or in the Commission, or you do it through the IAEA.
Top officials within the Biden administration, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have admitted that the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by Trump against Iran has failed. However, despite the admission, the White House seems to be still following up that proven failed policy.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Sarah Flanders, co-director, International Action Center out of New York. And Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Sarah in New York. I mean, what is going on this time? We see on the one hand, the United States says it wants to actually return to talks. On the other hand, we see just these mixed signals in general regarding its return to the JCPOA. Your analysis of what's going on, Sarah?
Well, it really is duplicity. There's no other way to explain this. Of course, it was President Trump who walked away from the agreement that was signed with all of these countries and with the UN Security Council and recognized, and the U.S. did not abide by the agreement, did not lift the sanctions, and then broke the agreement. So Biden, during the election campaign, promised he would return, but he took the same tact as President Trump had taken, and that is, he said he would return with conditions. He wanted to raise new points, which were exactly Donald Trump's points. So it shows he wasn't sincere at all. It was just election campaigning, and that the U.S. fully intends to continue the sanctions on Iran, the demands on Iran, and demanding that its allies in Europe, who are the former colonial powers, back it up on these preposterous demands against Iran, that Iran become defenseless. And we know from, and as countries have learned from bitter experience, what happens when you certify that you're defenseless, that you're disarmed. Iraq suddenly certainly learned that, as did Libya, that the next day the U.S. bombs come, the complete destruction of the country comes. So Iran has every right to a drone and a missile program in defense of its own people. And for the U.S. to try to put that on the negotiating table is preposterous.
Okay. Well, Elijah, well, you just heard Sarah and saying that Iran has all the rights to have a missile and drone defense program. On the other hand, we've just seen the U.S. actually implement more sanctions against Iran dealing with its drone technology. So on the one hand, once again, it's saying we're ready to talk, we're ready to negotiate. On the other hand, they're continually increasing the sanctions. Though this has been happening for 40 years, and they see that Iran not only is still standing, but getting stronger. Elijah, what does it take? Why is it that they do not change direction to try to get a different result?
Thank you for having me. I fully agree with what Sarah said. Moreover, I think the Americans are trying to show to the world that they can be more clever than President Obama and they can negotiate a better deal, which is not quite right because they're not negotiating a better deal. They're not negotiating the same deal, but they're trying to avoid the deal that existed since 2015 and that Iran specifically said there is no other deal but this one. Now, because Iran is not saying either you return to the 2015 deal that was signed at the time of Obama, or we are out and we continue our nuclear cycle and we complete it to 90%, even though we're not interested in the bomb. However, Iran is allowing diplomacy to take its time and is not saying to the world that I'm not interested. But on the other hand, we see that the Americans are just playing around and trying to gain time, using exactly the same excuses and the same terminology by saying all options are on the table. But on the other hand, it's so simple. You want the nuclear deal, just lift all the sanctions, bring it back as it was in 2015, respect it, and guarantee that you're not going to revoke it. Now, for Iran, this is very difficult because Iran lost a lot of money by pouring in cement in Iraq nuclear facility, in stopping all the program, and is not ready to do that again when there are no guarantees from the U.S. And U.S. is not in a position willingly to offer any guarantee to Iran and to return to the JCPOA agreement, go back to the table and say, we lift all the sanctions and we talk about all the other issues separately. Now, this is not what President Biden administration is offering. It's just offering a negotiation, is offering to return to the table, be present around the table with the 4+1, and to talk about other issues. This is not going to happen. It's a waste of time.
Well, Sarah, what about that? Elijah just said it's a waste of time. Because also we've seen, speaking about the European signatories now, very interestingly, I mean, they did not live up to their side of the deal after the U.S. left. And now, let me just quote exactly, basically, they're putting pressure, trying to put pressure on Iran and saying Iran needs to change its attitude, needs to change its ways. What is that about as far as the Europeans? Because on the one side, they say that, no, Iran was right and they have the right. They should stay with the JCPOA and continue adhering to its commitments, and Europe was going to do its best to do so also, which that was not the case.
Well, it really shows that they're not reliable. They are in an alliance with the U.S. Of course, they also have their own business interests. So they were interested, for their own self-interest, in ending the sanctions on Iran. However, when the U.S. walked away, that's exactly what happened. They could have continued their arrangements, business deals, and so on with Iran. But they were more fearful of U.S. penalties and sanctions on them. So in total self-interest, they broke an agreement they had also signed. It's really disgraceful, and yet it's not surprising, because this is who Iran is forced to negotiate with. These are imperialist powers. They really seek, in many different ways, at different angles, the destruction of Iran and its nationally owned oil and resources. That's what they want to destroy. They want to be able to call the shots, all of them together. And so, of course, they are for the U.S. succeeding, if that's possible. If not, they'll play a middle role if there's no cost to them. But they're refusing to go ahead with a deal they had also signed shows that they're also not reliable. And Iran is saying, we'll return. Here's the agreement. You all signed it. Let's go back to it. All you have to do is sit down at the table and abide by it. But it's clear that's not what the U.S. wants to do, and the U.S.'s government and all their officials are trying to pull in, through their banking power, through their financial leverage, these other countries. What's the room for negotiating in a situation like that? There was a deal. It was signed. It should be returned to. And it's absolutely clear, Iran's position isn't murky. It's we have an agreement. You have an agreement? Let's go back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's not what the U.S. wants. Their aim in every way is to see if they can't split, divide, make new concessions in Iran. And that's been the purpose of all negotiating. What could they promise without delivering anything, even a lifting of any of the sanctions, but what could they promise that would divide Iranians and create false expectations? I think the Iranians are sophisticated enough. They saw through it. But they did, in all honesty, and in agreement with it, they stopped their nuclear program. They actually shut it down, did damage to it. Because they were keeping their part of the bargain, and they showed the world that they were. But should they do that again? It's hard to justify it.
Mm-hmm.
And should they even do more and get rid of their drone and missile program, their only line of defense? I can't picture that being even a reasonable demand.
Well, Elijah, you know, listening to Sarah and talking about the European signatories. I mean, on the one hand, it was actually in their benefit to keep the deal and actually have business with Iran, a very vibrant society and growing society. On the other hand, because of pressure from the U.S., it's as if these European signatories have no sovereignty whatsoever, that they too then basically, it's more afraid of the bully on the block, the United States. Your assessment of that, is it that or no, they're just all in this together, Elijah?
Absolutely. In Europe, government and leaders, decision makers, are terrified of the sanctions of the U.S. We saw what the Americans did to BNP Paribas by sanctioning it with $9 billion plus for violating the U.S. unilateral sanctions on Sudan, China, and Iran. Therefore, we saw how the European company, the oil company, withdrew from Iran and paid the penalty for fear of being sanctioned by the U.S. The U.S. has maintained 119 military base in Germany, 25 military base in the U.K., 24 bases in Portugal, 45 bases in Italy. They literally occupy Europe without saying it. And also, we saw how the Europeans are reacting slowly but surely to the U.S. hegemony and saying, we have enough, but they are just words and they're not acting accordingly. So since 2018, Europe offered nothing to Iran, did not respect the JCPOA. They're not better than the U.S. The only difference is the U.S. just voiced the decision by Donald Trump in 2018, where the president said, I'm no longer respecting the JCPOA. Why the Europeans are even worse, because they did not say that, but they did not dare to do otherwise, and they did not respect the end of the deal. So there's no point for Iran to rely on Europe, even if Iran is using Europe as an intermediary and is trying to say that I am doing my best to keep the negotiation. I am not putting off the Vienna talk, but it's not going to lead very far because Europe is not going to be able to offer anything. And the dialogue between the Iranian deputy foreign minister, Bakeri Kani, and Enrique Mora was very clear. Europe is saying to Iran, we are with you, we understand your point of view, but we can't do much about it.
Well, Sarah, is all of this basically about still 42 years later, the United States never being able to accept Iran's sovereignty, respecting the victory of the revolution and accepting that it is a reality? Are we still talking about regime change? Is this what it's all about at the end of the day?
At the end of the day, this is what it's all about. U.S. sanctions, U.S. regime change plan really far predates Iran's nuclear program. And from the very beginning of the Iranian Revolution, this was to be the U.S. pillar of domination in the whole region. And the Iranian Revolution, the Iranian people upset U.S. plans. And ever since then, from day one, have come the sanctions. And it's important to actually always state that the sanctions predate the nuclear program by every measure. And the question of Iran developing needed nuclear energy is a totally false, fraudulent issue. Iran is doing no more than half the countries of the world. To have nuclear energy in terms of industry is pretty vital today. So it's vital even in medical technology today. So to deprive Iran of this and to make it Iran seem to be that they're threatening, they are a threat to the U.S. in their determination to control their own resources, to set their own course, to assert their own sovereignty. and to fully educate their population. They've provided for their population in a way that countries that are under the thumb, under U.S. domination, don't do to this day. Iran is surrounded by very corrupt, feudal monarchies that provide nothing for their population, but put a lot of money into U.S. banks. Now, that's the relationship the U.S. wants to have again with Iran, and those days aren't coming back. It's like the British wishing for a return of their empire. Those days aren't coming back. And that's true around the world. It is a huge underestimation, of where we're at in history. And unfortunately, the U.S. is not getting the message.
Elijah, where do you see all this going? Because on the one hand, there are those that say all of this is really about Iran's independence and, of course, support for the resistance. On the other hand, the United States, of course, says it's about the nuclear program and others. So at this point in time, I mean, Iran's foreign minister said, okay, so if they really want to return to the deal, then Biden can sign an executive order and all the sanctions can be removed, return to the deal, Iran returns the deal. So where do you see this going?
I don't think the suggestion of Foreign Minister Abdullahian is good enough, because Iran has $110 billion as a frozen asset in different countries. So releasing $10 billion and then negotiating with the U.S. and listening to the U.S. saying, we are not lifting, we're not removing all the sanctions, and we will not abide by the JCPOA as it was, it just will lead to very little outcome, really. So what I see things are going is the Americans are enjoying looking at Iran under sanctions, because the sanctions are implemented, adding more, and saying to the Iranian that we will continue imposing sanctions, because they really looking very hard to impose more sanctions, because everything is sanctions today in Iran. So the Americans will continue with this policy. They are really not very interested in what's happening in West Asia, and they're more concerned about the threat coming from China, how they describe it, and the waking up of Russia and the expansion of Russia in different area in a different way, offering a different model from the U.S. So in the Middle East and West Asia, the Americans are pulling back a bit, and they're really not interested in lifting sanctions on Iran, because they are afraid what Iran is capable of and how Iran can support his allies throughout the world, and that is include Venezuela, Lebanon, Syria, Gaza, Iraq, and Yemen. And I don't see the Americans just watching happily Iran having back $110 billion, being able to sell its oil and recovering its economy. I don't think this is going to happen.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on the Spotlight. Sarah Flanders, co-director, International Action Center out of New York. Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Bye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright. and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. For such is the state of the disbelievers, until when death comes to one of them, he says, "My Lord, send me back." That I might do righteousness in that which I left behind. No, it is only a word he is saying, and behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the 100th verse of the chapter. وَمِن وَرَائِهِمْ بَرْزَخٌ إِلَى يَوْمِ يُبْعَثُونَ. And behind them is a partition until the day when they shall be raised up. In 99th and the 100th verse, talking about the unbelievers, the stubbornness of the pagans and their wrong way, when death comes to one of them, he says, "O Lord, send me back again so I can do righteousness." But the Almighty Allah says, "No, this is just a simple word that he says," and behind them is a partition. Regarding partition, we have talked through a couple of programs. Concerning the life in Barzakh, we have mentioned a couple of points, but there are some other aspects to be discussed. We have different expressive illustrations mentioned in the different verses of the Holy Quran. One of them is that when a human being dies, his soul will be placed in a subtle body. This body is completely unlike the body of this world, because it is not subject to the accidents that affect the physical body in the world of matter. Since this subtle body is in every other aspect like the worldly body, it is idiomatically called an atom-like body or form. It is neither completely non-material nor it is completely material. It participates in a kind of immateriality of the intermediate world, the life of Barzakh. Some scholars have likened the state of the soul in Barzakh to the state of the soul when a human being is asleep. In that state, when the human being is asleep, the soul may really experience pleasure and pain in an even sharper way than when in the physical state, and it can enjoy a pleasure so much or can get so upset by a painful experience that their effects can sometimes be seen on the body itself. The body will smile, the body will cry, or the body might be filled with surprise or shout in pain.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Some even believe that at the time of sleep, the soul really acts in the atom-like body, and more importantly, some believe that those who have more powerful souls, when they are not asleep, they can also be in the state of non-materiality of the intermediate world while being conscious. This, dear listeners, means that they can leave the body, they can get out of their body, they can travel in this body and be aware of their surroundings and their state, and consciously witness the events, but maybe without being seen. Some of the scholars even specify that an atom-like form exists in every human body. But when a person is going to die and begin the life of the intermediate world, that form leaves the body. Sometimes, as we said, it is possible that in this very material life of the world, it separates from the body, and this is another time that it happens. Even if we do not accept these characteristics of the atom-like body, the main principle cannot be denied, the reality of Barzakh, because it is rationally possible, and it is referred to in many narrations as well, apart from the verses of the Holy Quran that talk about Barzakh explicitly, and many of them yet implicitly. Based on what we said, you may remember that some critics say that the belief in the existence of an atom-like body would necessitate belief in metempsychosis or tanasukh. But we assert that reincarnation is nothing but the transference of one soul into different bodies. The late Sheikh Baha'i, an Islamic great scholar, in response to this criticism, said very clearly that the reincarnation that all Muslims unanimously reject is the rebirth of the soul in another body in this world after the destruction of the body. We will inshallah talk about this aspect of Barzakh more in the next programs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
While France's weekly protests against the corona vaccine pass have become greatly diminished, probably because Parliament appears certain to approve using the so-called health pass until after next spring's elections, the yellow vests continue to turn out in significant numbers nationwide. For several months, the two groups have often been conflated by the mainstream media, but the anti-vaccine pass protests are organized by a leading far-right politician, while the yellow vests disavow links to any political party, but especially the far right. The yellow vests often march in several different groups in Paris, but they share essentially the same reasons for protesting.
We will be marching every Saturday to demand our human rights and our human dignity. We are here because there is no economic justice in France. France is an oligarchy composed of political elite, union leaders, and high finance. They suck the life and riches out of the real producers of our nation's wealth, the workers.
The yellow vests began 3 years ago in response to record high gas prices. Around Europe, energy prices have just exploded to new records. However, there is even more economic difficulty and instability now than when the yellow vests first took to the streets.
Inflation is at its highest point since 2008. Back then, unemployment was 30% lower than it is today. Economic growth is widely expected to slow dramatically from this quarter onwards. The era of austerity has left France economically unprepared for the coronavirus era, and many believe that social unrest could return to the shocking levels of 2019.
En Tunisie, etc.
I think what you're seeing is similar to the revolutions which began in Tunisia and swept the Arab world. The abuse of human liberty by our government is provoking the same type of conditions in France. They say that there is no more yellow vests. It's not true. We are right here and living on our feet instead of dying on our knees.
French media coverage of the yellow vests diminished to almost nothing in May of 2019. Just 3 weeks into season two, seemingly no domestic media witnessed the demonstrations in Paris. Contrarily, there continues to be an overwhelming police presence of seemingly one heavily armed riot cop for every two protesters, increasing the chances for provocation and violence against unarmed protesters. Rami Mazaheri, Paris.
Saudi Arabia has ordered the Lebanese ambassador to the country to leave over what the kingdom refers to as offensive remarks by the Lebanese information minister regarding the ongoing war by Saudi-led coalition against Yemen. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a ban on all imports from Lebanon. At the same time, the Saudi Foreign Ministry has expressed regret over the deteriorating relations between Riyadh and Beirut, accusing Lebanon of ignorance and failure to take corrective measures to improve the bilateral ties between the two countries. All these came amid a call by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi for an end to the Saudi-sponsored war on Yemen, a devastating war with a simultaneous siege that have been killing and displacing Yemenis for more than 6 years now, a catastrophe that even the United Nations refers to as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Recently, the kingdom also classified a Beirut-based financial charity body as a terrorist entity, froze all the association's assets, and banned all sorts of financial transactions with it, all for the charity's ties with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. Lebanon-Saudi relations have been in free fall for years, but the kingdom's flagrant interference in Lebanon's internal affairs has intensified in the past few years. The highlight of that would be the unexpected resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri during a trip to Riyadh under Saudi degrading treatment and pressure. A year before that, Hariri had reached a power-sharing deal with Hezbollah and had attempted to convince Riyadh of the need to work with the resistance group. In 2016, Saudi Arabia halted $1 billion worth of aid to the Lebanese army, citing the country's regional ties. Those are followed by the latest series of Saudi sanctions against Lebanon, including the prohibition of its citizens from traveling to the country. However, Riyadh does not always act alone. Similar to its conduct in Yemen with regional allies and under Western support, it pressures some other Persian Gulf countries, sometimes through threats and sometimes through leverages, to fill in its footsteps. After controversy over Hariri's resignation, Kuwait and the UAE joined the kingdom to urge their citizens to leave Lebanon. The UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait all summoned their envoys in Lebanon in protest to the recent statements of the Lebanese Information Minister. In 2017, the very same group of countries, alongside Egypt, collectively severed their ties with Qatar, citing a variety of reasons, including support for terrorism or Qatar's backing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, allegations that were all strongly rejected by Doha. Therefore, one can say that the current Saudi measures against Lebanon, especially at the time of heightened economic instability and insecurity, would do nothing but deteriorate the already worsening crises in the Arab country.
Saudi Arabia has banned all imports from Lebanon after criticisms of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen by Lebanon's Information Minister George Kordahi. The United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Kuwait also summoned their envoys to Lebanon in a protest to Kordahi's comments. The concerted move has sparked outrage in Yemen, where people have unanimously condemned it. Yemenis say Riyadh can't stop the free people from telling the truth about its years-long war on the country.
Saudi Arabia has already violated the principles of Arab solidarity and Arab commercial cooperation and other related covenants issued by the Arab League. This reveals the autocratic nature of Saudi Arabia's rulers. We see a short-sighted approach in Saudi Arabia's foreign policy. The country is seeking to silence any voice against it, whether in Yemen or elsewhere.
Meanwhile, Yemeni officials have called for banning the imports from Saudi Arabia in response to the Saudi halt on Lebanon imports.
Yemenis pay tribute to the stances of Lebanese Minister of Information, George Kordahi. His remarks made in support of Yemenis against the Saudi aggression. There are growing public calls in Yemen to ban Saudi products in solidarity with Lebanon.
In an interview on Monday, Kordahi described the Yemen war as futile and said it was time to end it. He also defended Yemen's Ansarullah movement, saying they were defending themselves against an external aggression.
People, he say, they will stand by the Lebanese brothers to stop Riyadh's violations of Lebanon's sovereignty. They called on the free people of the world to support Kordahi for his brave statements amid the continued international apathy toward the Saudi war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future. The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health, and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city center demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charities representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The night in March 2021 that 33-year-old Sarah Everard was arrested, raped and murdered by police officer Wayne Curzons. He has been handed a life sentence, but since the murder, public trust in the force has plummeted. In 4 years, 2,000 officers have been accused of sexual misconduct, including rape. nearly two-thirds of them have faced no further action, and a quarter of misconduct hearings are closed to the public. Britain's most senior police officer has promised a thorough investigation into the Met's culture, and the Independent Force for Police Conduct says it is dealing with a slew of new referrals since it changed the criteria for abuse of power for sexual purposes.
But is it about referral criteria or something more ingrained and sinister? Cousins was nicknamed the rapist by his colleagues, so why wasn't he weeded out earlier by the Met?
Climate change is sort of steroids for the weather. That's what experts say. From the northernmost to the southernmost points of the Earth, nowhere and no one is immune to this crisis. In India, people have been devastated by frequent heat waves.
We are affected a lot by this unbearable heat, and us poor are hit the hardest.
And so are Canadians.
It's just unbearable. It's impossible to be out.
This year, July was declared the world's hottest month ever recorded. A recent study shows if the world's emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases continues at the same level, in 30 years' time, there will be a climate change apocalypse. That means outdoor life in parts of the Middle East and North Africa would be impossible, regions that are already facing long periods of extreme heat.
We are very tired and cannot stand in the sun. Our situation is very bad. We are exhausted.
Researchers are now warning that even animals and plants are in danger. In a bid to survive, some countries are already looking for new ways to adapt to these intense situations. In Bangladesh, one of the countries worst affected by the extreme weather in recent decades, farmers are developing floating seed beds and salt-resistant rice to avoid unpredictable conditions.
This is the digital age. We saw on YouTube how greenhouse farming works. We tried it on a smaller scale, though. I am doing greenhouse farming this year on 8,000 square feet of land.
Estimates show that $5 trillion a year are needed by 2030 to find measures to fight global warming. But despite signs of progress in a few sectors, the majority of the tasks required for curbing the rising temperatures still seem to be far-fetched. And many are now saying that the upcoming United Nations conference, COP26, is the last major chance to galvanize a collective effort to fight climate change.
Unless there are immediate, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we will be unable to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and the consequences will be catastrophic. COP26 this November must mark that turning point. By then, we need all countries to commit to achieve net zero emissions by the middle of this century and to present clear, credible, long-term strategies to get there.
All these are reminders that the fatal consequences of this human-induced crisis are threatening our planet now more than ever before.
Afghanistan has welcomed the recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Muhammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leaders' remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity and make it a culture.
Addressing the 55th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to instill sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's latest unemployment data showed a small improvement, but unemployment remains nearly 8%, at least officially. 5.9 million people remain unemployed, which is just a fraction less than the all-time high of 6.3 million in 2017. Back in September 2008, the total jobless numbered just 4.5 million. That means French unemployment has risen over 30% since the start of the Great Recession. With re-election just 6 months away, many say that Macron is running out of time to devote resources to the jobless or to devise a new system of accounting. Macron campaigned on a promise to bring unemployment under 7%.
His effort, his promise to increase employment by changing labor laws that would make France more attractive to foreign investors just hasn't worked. This idea of bringing in migrants for cheap labor to keep wages down is a real issue. So it's a big problem for Macron.
Under Macron's predecessor, François Hollande, the jobless rate increased 44 out of 46 months at one point. To change that, Hollande controversially started excluding part-time underemployed workers from the official count. Macron went one better and declared that just looking for work once in the past month no longer makes someone unemployed. Macron also began revealing jobless data only once every 3 months to avoid media discussion of the unpopular issue.
We have to really distinguish between what the official unemployment rate is and what the unofficial unemployment rate is. And if we take what the potential workforce is, it's much, much higher. And it's really amazing because the service sectors, like restaurants and bars and stores and stuff, can't find people to fill positions. And the reason is they don't pay enough.
For years, many French economists have said that the official unemployment rate is undercounted by a third, which would put the real unemployment rate at well over 20%. The Macron era had been one of constant economic unrest, but the coronavirus pause seems to have ended, with protests recently increasing in number and intensity. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadadi, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is our dear friend and Islamic researcher Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi from the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our question today is as follows. What is the meaning of the slogan of Amit Amit, meaning kill, kill? Is the intended target of this slogan the Jews, meaning when the Imam, peace be upon him, appears, arrives, will he then via this slogan target the Jews, or is there another meaning behind this slogan?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we have many narrations that talk about the the time when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear.
Right.
And there will be a great attack from the enemies towards the Imam, like they want to kill him. He will raise in the